This is Barron's Live. Each weekday, we bring you live conversations from our newsrooms about what's moving the market right now. On this podcast, we take you inside those conversations, the stories, the ideas, and the stocks to watch so you can invest smarter. Now, let's dial in.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Barron's Live, our daily webcast and podcast. I'm Lauren Rublin, Senior Managing Editor of Barron's. Thanks for joining us today to learn more about the week ahead in stocks and important economic and investment trends. I've got two great guests today. Barron's Deputy Editor Ben Levison joins me with a preview of coming earnings announcements and economic news, and Robert Phipps, a partner at Peirce Sterling, a Texas-based investment advisory firm, is here to discuss the macroeconomic outlook. Bob is also one of the money managers who participated in our latest big money poll of institutional investors. We wrote up the findings in a cover story in this past weekend's issue of Barron's. Welcome, Bob and Ben. So glad to have you on Barron's Live today.
Thanks, Lauren.
So, Bob, I want to start by thanking you for responding to the big money poll. You've been a regular respondent, and we really appreciate your loyalty and your insights. This is a poll with about 30 questions that we send out twice a year in the spring and fall to a group of institutional investors. And the first question we ask in big money is whether respondents consider themselves bullish, bearish, or neutral about the outlook for stocks over the next 12 months. I went back through the data this weekend, and it looks to me like you answered that you're bullish on the outlook for stocks, yet like about 40% of poll respondents, you said the market is overvalued as opposed to undervalued or fairly valued. So I wonder if you can explain this seeming contradiction, why you're bullish on stocks, even though you think the market is overvalued.
The stock market is overvalued based upon almost any measure that you could use that's not based almost entirely on interest rates. In fact, if you look at traditional, price book, price earnings, the stock market is in the top 5 or 10% of its historic trading range. That said, and I hate to use an overused term, but in some regards, it's the best house in a bad neighborhood. There just aren't that many other opportunities to invest your money where you're likely to stay ahead of inflation and taxes. We do believe that we're in a bull market. We do believe, however, that it is a bull market that is changing somewhat. I think we're past the stage where we had a core of investors that would jump in anytime that you'd see a 2% pullback. And in particular, anytime the S&P would touch the 50-day moving average, investors would just pile back in and buy every dip. I think that this is a different, more measured type of market going forward, but still one of the more attractive places in the world to put your money.
So I'm going to put Ben on the spot here. We don't let staffers share their opinions in the big money poll, but Ben, had you received the poll, how would you answer the first question? Bullish, bearish, or neutral? Have we lost Ben?
Ah, shoot. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now.
All right. So you heard the oh, shoot.
That's all right.
I may be having some connection problems. So if I go out, I will call back in on my phone. Okay. I will put lots of caveats on this. I think for right now, I'm neutral. I think the market is expensive and it needs to go sideways for a while, particularly because people don't quite know what to get, what they're going to get from earnings. There's a lot of concerns about inflation, about supply chains and things like that. And I think that what might happen is that we could get the market going sideways, earnings will turn out better than people expect, and then the market can rally because of that. But it may take some time just to digest everything that we've done so far.
All right, so we've got you in the neutral camp. So a question for you, Bob. The market has just experienced its first correction of at least 5%. Do you think that correction has run its course before the bull starts running again?
I would say that there are a couple of the criteria that you look for to identify a tradable bottom that have taken place. We had a reaction low in the third week of last month where we had a spike in bearish sentiment. We had a spike in volume. We've come back and retested those lows, and it seems to be a sustainable retest. We did see the sentiment numbers, whether it's the American Association of Individual Investors or the Bull Bear Survey or the National Association of Active Investment Managers, or even the CNN Fear and Greed Index, all cooled off quite a bit. So we got rid of some of the excess bullish sentiment. The VIX actually touched as high as 29 before settling back down. And while it doesn't look like we've had much of a correction this year, that's actually a little deceiving, because if you look at, in fact, there's data that just came out of Charles Schwab, where as of the end of last week, 91% of all S&P stocks have corrected at least 10% at some point this year, with an average decline of 18. The NASDAQ has actually had 90% of all stocks decline by at least 10%, but an average correction of 38%. So we've actually seen a fairly violent rotation in the market. So we've actually kind of had corrective activity throughout the year. In point of fact, as of September, almost half of all the NYSE traded stocks had fallen below their 200-day moving average, meaning that they had at least gone, they had violated their long-term uptrend. We are getting a bit of a bounce on the earnings reports we've seen thus far, and that's encouraging. But I would encourage people not to extrapolate that too far. Most of the earnings we've gotten thus far are from banks, and banks aren't subject to the supply chain disruptions, et cetera, that much of the market is. So I wouldn't necessarily extrapolate those great numbers going forward. The market still also needs to prove an ability to break and sustain above its old highs.
All right. Thanks for that. I think Ben lost connection for a moment, so I'm going to put the next question to you. Ben had an excellent up and down Wall Street column this weekend discussing the threat of stagflation, that is the dreaded combo of rising inflation and slowing economic growth. What do you think about the stagflation argument, Bob? Ben didn't think it's something we really need to worry about, though we seem to love talking about it. What's your take on it?
Well, I think, first of all, it's important to understand what makes stagflation such a unique problem, because it's the one undesirable macroeconomic condition that the Fed doesn't have an answer for, a way to address. If they raise interest rates and tighten money supply to try to take some of the inflation out of the picture, what they'll end up doing is further causing the stag. You know, if they try to battle inflation, they're going to further slow the economy. If they try to stimulate the economy, they're going to further exacerbate inflation. So it really is a dichotomy that they don't really have an answer to. There's no doubt we do have significant slowing. If you look at the Atlanta Fed nowcast, which is a real-time estimate of economic growth, it has slid from high single digits earlier this year all the way down to 1.2% as of today. Inflation is also undesirably high. CPI year over year is 5.38%, so more than double the Fed's 2% target. That said, this is not the 70s. I agree with Ben. Back in the 70s, unions were very strong. Contracts had automatic wage escalators in them. We don't really see that today. We had two oil shocks. We abandoned the gold standard. There were a lot of shocks that created a stagflationary environment that we're not likely to see replicated here. That said, there are several things that are causing what is, at least in the short term, stagflation, starting with the fact that we saw explosive money supply growth last year. The Fed or the government normally raises money supply, increases M2 by about 1% over GDP growth. Last year, they grew M2 by 27% and the economy shrank 3%. So we actually ballooned money supply by 30% over GDP. That money was far bigger than it could be consumed in the real economy. It poured into the financial markets, which is why we saw the fastest rebound from a bear market in history. You combine all that excess money floating around, which is now available for consumer spending, combined with the huge fiscal stimulus and the extended unemployment benefits. Then on top of that, all the supply chain snafus we're seeing. We do have in the short term quite a few elements of stagflation. Now, that I do believe is a relatively short-term phenomenon. There are still major deflationary forces in place: globalization, digitization, demographics, technology. So I think with the passage of time and a sustained reopening and progress on the pandemic, That should help to alleviate these stagflationary pressures probably sometime in 2022.
That's comforting to know. Thank you. So you and Ben seem to be on the same page. Let's move on and take a look at this week's earnings report. Ben, we'll start with Tesla. Stock is up about 22% year to date to $860. What's on tap earnings wise, and will it be enough to move Tesla shares even higher?
Well, I do want to point out that while Tesla is up 22% this year, it's actually up 33% during the past 3 months. So all the gains this year really have come now. It was actually down before three months ago for the year. So that sets up some pretty high expectations. I can tell you with near certainty that Tesla will beat its earnings forecasts. Al Root wrote a great trader column this weekend. One of the things he noted is that Tesla's been providing updates. They've had deliveries and things like that. And if you do the math on that, you're going to see earnings beat the forecast, particularly because the expectations, not all the analysts have raised their expectations based off those delivery numbers. And so the expectations actually remain too low. And so you're going to probably get a beat and probably a pretty decent one. And so I think the bar is pretty high here just because of the size of the gains that it's had in the last 3 months. And because of just how low the estimates remain, close to what kind of we know is reality. But Tesla has really, something has changed here in terms of sentiment. It just seems like people are getting excited about the stock again. It really went sideways for quite a while there after that enormous run-up. And so I think it's going to take, you know, if they can beat those numbers or they can give good news about things like production in its factories in Germany and in Austin, and really show that production could keep increase, they should be okay. Though I wouldn't be surprised if there is a near-term pullback.
Interesting situation there. Next up, I want to talk about is Biogen. Before I do, I want to remind listeners that we'll take questions at the end of the call. Please type in your questions as we keep speaking. So Biogen is a biotech company that reports this week. The company's Alzheimer's drug has been struggling in the market. And on Sunday, it announced that its experimental drug for ALS kind of failed in a pivotal trial. So I wonder, Ben, do earnings even matter at this point for Biogen?
Probably not. And we're going to hear this, I think, over and over again for a lot of companies right now, is that the earnings are probably, maybe it's not fair to say the furthest things from investor minds, but they are thinking about other things. In the case of Biogen, that Alzheimer's drug just hangs over everything. The stock got such a big bounce when it was approved, but the controversy around it has really made it, from what we've seen of some of the data out there, is it seems like doctors really aren't prescribing it that much. And so investors are going to be looking at the earnings to see, is there any pickup here? Are doctors using this more than what we've seen so far? Is there a chance for it to become a real revenue generator despite all that controversy?
But isn't the controversy, I just want to go back to the controversy for a minute. Yeah. Isn't it in part because of the price, it's $56,000, and in part because there are questions about whether it works?
Yeah, I think it's less about the price than it is about whether it works. The price, if it worked, you'd pay it.
Right, you'd pay anything.
But exactly. What we don't know is if it works. We know that it impacts what the drug targets. The problem is that there is the evidence that what it targets actually makes Alzheimer's better or prevents it isn't great. And that's the real problem. It's like targeting cholesterol, saying that it's going to reduce heart disease, and then finding out lowering cholesterol actually doesn't reduce heart disease. And so that's a big problem for them. And then the fact that there was a panel that actually said an FDA panel said the drug should not be approved, and the FDA went ahead and approved it anyway, just added to the controversy around it. And people really don't know, does it work well enough to prescribe? Is it worth the price tag? And for now, the answer seems to be probably not, at least from the doctor's point of view. So we're going to see what those sales look like now. And I think that more than anything, more than the earnings themselves, are going to really be the important thing for Biogen.
That makes sense to me. What about Netflix? The stock has been surging for quite a while. Of course, they've got the Squid Game. It's supposed to be the most popular Netflix show of recent times, if not all time. What are we expecting to hear from Netflix on the earnings front?
Netflix is an interesting one because, like Tesla, all its gains have come this quarter. It's up 18% over the last 3 months and 16% year to date. This turning point for them really came when Disney the CEO was speaking at a conference and said that streaming wasn't growing as fast as it was before. And I think there's been this idea that, well, you know what, maybe it's really easy to catch up to a Netflix, to become a Netflix. And especially when you're Disney with all these movies, and Disney is showing that maybe it's not so easy. That, you know, they had this rapid growth immediately, but now they're running into some issues. And that, I think, has gotten investors to feel more excited about the company. This is another one that probably the earnings don't matter as much as other things. In this case, subscriber growth. People are going to be looking to see what the subscribers are doing, particularly internationally. I was reading something from Dan Morgan over at Synovus. He was pointing out that in the United States, it's pretty much saturated. Everyone that is going to have a Netflix account probably does. So you have to look outside the U.S. For that growth, and that's where investors will be looking when they report.
Okay, we'll keep watching that. I'm not sure we'll be watching Squid Game, however. Sounds a little violent for me. All right, tell us about IBM. They've got a spinoff going on, and what do the earnings look like there?
Well, the earnings are going to drop. They're supposed to fall to 252 from 258 a year ago. The stock is, you know, it's up 15%, so it's relatively close to what the market is doing this year. But again, this is another stock where it feels like so many companies right now, it's less about the earnings and more about what they are doing. In this case, spinning off, I'm going to mispronounce this, but Kyndryl, which I believe is their managed infrastructure business. Analysts seem pretty bullish on this. They think that this is going to allow IBM to grow faster. IBM plans to keep, I think, a little less than 20% of the stock in that unit for itself. And it's going to try to do some debt exchanges to lower its debt that it has now. We'll see what their comments are about that. And so in a sense, it's going to be less about these earnings, which aren't going to be great. They're not growing. And that's what they have to do. And we've heard IBM for years talk about how they're going to rejuvenate their businesses. And as of yet, the evidence is still mixed. It is probably a better chance now than it has been at any time in the past with the Red Hat acquisition and whatnot. But it is, it's still, I think, it's kind of a show me case.
That's fair enough. Before we go on to more earnings, I want to stop for a minute and ask Bob. I know you are precluded from talking about individual stocks on this call, but I'm curious what market sectors you really like. What looks particularly attractive to you sector-wise, and what looks problematic to you?
Well, first of all, let me put the current market environment into a little bit of context. If you look at forward earnings for the next 10 years based on current valuations, the stock market actually tends to average about a 0 to 1% gain. So do understand this is a very expensive market. That's not necessarily our forecast, but do understand that the lesson of history is when you're so highly valued, markets have already made most of their gains. It's also true that at current inflation rates, the average 1 year forward return on the S&P 500 is 1.2%. So we do have some stiff headwinds. Now, we do also have, we're about to enter into what is a very strong seasonal pattern. Markets, and history does not always repeat itself, but markets have tended to produce most of their gains between mid-October and mid-April. So we're about to enter into that period. I do think this is going to be very much of a stock picking environment rather than an environment that's great for indexers. We rather like financials. Because if interest rates are going to be moving higher, as we expect, banks in particular tend to make their money on the difference in yield between short-term rates at which they acquire money and long-term rates at which they end money. So as they lend money. So as that yield curve steepens, that tends to boost profits for financials. We think that the energy sector, and particularly some of the less obvious energy plays, are very interesting. Globally, we're in the midst of going from powering ourselves with carbon-based fuels to renewables. We're trying to make this transition at a time where we don't have enough renewables to allow the jump to be smooth. So I think that, there's some interesting places such as even uranium miners, things like rare earth mineral mining, those sorts of things that are interesting. Nat gas companies, I think, have some interesting prospects here. In general, we would prefer value and cyclical, economically sensitive stocks over the defensive and technology stocks. And we tend to be a growth and technology investor. But I think with so much of the fiscal and monetary stimulus waning, a lot of, I think we've reached an earnings peak, et cetera. So one of the major drivers going forward is the likelihood of improvement of the pandemic, and that will result in a full reopening of the economy. So that should help value, should help cyclical. Also should favor small and mid caps, which tend to be more economically sensitive, over the larger brethren. They have the additional benefit of selling at 15 and 16 times forward earnings, as opposed to 20 times forward earnings, which is what the larger caps are selling for. I think you still, though, want to keep some quality growth exposure, but I would start weighting towards value and cyclical and smaller companies.
I like that you're not married to one particular style.
Sometimes you need to date. Sometimes you need to marry. This is, I think, a changing market. I think one of the most important influences of the market is going to be interest rates. Higher interest rates do tend to compress market multiples, which means that that should favor less highly valued stocks. I think in particular, companies that have very promising technologies, you know, that are innovation type companies, but where their earnings are years into the future, they may really struggle a little bit in this environment, because with higher interest rates, they basically discount the value of future earnings.
So do you think the Fed is on track, based on consensus judgments, to begin tapering later this year, early next year?
Yeah, well, absolutely. We actually expect they'll probably taper as soon as November, perhaps December. We certainly expect for it to happen this year. We also think that they will raise rates at least once next year and probably twice. All that said, it's important to keep in mind, and this is often misunderstood, tapering is not tightening. It's simply a reduction in the amount of additional stimulus that they're putting in. Right now, the Fed is buying $120 billion worth of financial assets every month. They've given us guidance that they expect to finish the tapering by mid-year next year. That suggests that they're going to taper by about $20 billion per month. So it would go from 120 to 100 to 80, et cetera. But if you do the math, that still means that they're probably going to inject or purchase another $400 billion plus of financial assets through QE before they're done. Importantly, and I think a lot of people are surprised to hear this, if you look at how bonds versus stocks have handled a cessation of QE and taperings in the past, bonds have actually done better than you would expect. Bonds actually rallied at the end of QE1, QE2, QE3. They did sell off quite a bit in 2013 when Bernanke surprised them in a congressional testimony with the idea of tapering, because they really hadn't prepared the markets for it. Stocks actually is the asset class that has tended to struggle much more with tapering. They sold off after QE1, 2, and 3. We had a sell-off of about 6% in equities in 2013. And then in 2018, when the Fed announced that they were going to not only taper, but also start raising interest rates, and that it was going to be on autopilot and would be so dull, it would be like watching, I can't remember if it was grass grow or paint dry, one of the two, and we had a full-blown bear market. So I would actually worry a bit more about the outlook for stocks than I would bonds with the tapering. That said, I think the stock market will actually handle tapering much better this time than it has in the past, for a couple of reasons. The first of which is, the Fed has moved away from a proactive monetary policy. In the past, what they would do is they would start raising rates as soon as we started to see us approach the kind of our non-inflationary economic capacity. We also have a situation now where inflation is higher than it's been since the 70s and 80s. I think it's starting to really concern Wall Street. So as I look at the market and market sentiment right now, I actually think the stock market and the bond markets are both actually looking forward to tapering and ultimately even some modest interest rate increases, because they recognize that in the longer term, they absolutely do need to get a handle on inflation. And importantly, the Fed has made it very, very clear that this time it is not on autopilot. If the economy starts to slow, if inflationary pressures start to wane, if the macroeconomic picture changes, they're reserving the right to change the course of action.
Which seems sensible. But as you say, we are at a point of change. We've got a lot of changes ahead for investors. So I want to go to some listener questions. They've been coming in. We have a couple of biotech questions we'll get to on Thursday's call when I interview Josh Nathan Cases, our healthcare reporter. But in the meantime, some questions for today's call. We had a question from Hal about Zillow, and this is for you, Ben. I know you wanted to talk about this. The company announced it's suspending house buying through the fourth quarter. It's having a hard time finding people to renovate the houses it's bought. Part of its business model is to buy houses and flip them. It's going to put that on hold for a bit. The stock is down 9% today. Wall Street is quite unhappy. And Hal asks, what does this say about Zillow's business model and the wider housing market?
Well, I think it confirms a lot of what we already know about the housing market, is that houses are expensive, and that trying to get any work done on them is very difficult. I know anecdotally, you just talk to anyone who has plans to renovate a house, and or even to get little things, especially get little things done, but even big projects, it's just not easy and it's expensive. And I think that does call into question what's going on. It does call into question Zillow's business model right now. And I think they're acknowledging that they have to get the houses that they have finished up. They have to flip those. They have to maybe slow things down until things start to normalize. But I think there's just another sign of just how tight the labor market is, and how difficult it is to get, with all these shortages of workers in different areas, how hard it is to get work that might have been easy to get done a year or two ago is just not easy anymore.
Well, Wall Street is noted is not too happy about this. So I know we've got some housing numbers coming out this week. Do you want to run through them quickly?
Oh, there's actually, I don't think, a ton that's really going to move the needle. We're getting, housing starts are supposed to go up a tiny bit. Building permits are supposed to go down. Sales are supposed to go up. But I think as with everything right now, it's really just trying to make sense of all these other forces that are kind of buffeting the market at this point. What's causing starts to, they're going to be up a little bit, but basically flat. Why aren't starts picking up more? Is it because of difficulties getting workers and just how expensive it will be to build them? Why aren't the permits picking up? It could be very much the same kind of thing. The sales will be interesting just because it looks like they don't want to slow down and not too much. I think they've pulled back a little bit, but are supposed to pick up again. And, people are still buying houses. It's pretty amazing, even at these prices.
Well, rates are low. Now's the time, perhaps. But certainly the Zillow situation. Yep, Zillow situation is interesting to watch. Bob, we had a question about the big money poll. I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, that about 60% of managers said equities were their favorite asset class, and 11% or so said commodities were their favorite. Commodities came in as the second favorite. That's kind of unusual. Thomas asks, if the poll were redone today, although it was just done a couple of weeks ago, is there reason to expect that commodities would be much more highly favored versus equities? And I just wonder if we can expand upon that and ask your view of commodities.
I tend to invest in kind of the picks and shovels rather than the gold miners. In other words, let me rephrase that. That's not exactly correct. I would, rather than invest in the commodities themselves, I'd rather invest in the companies that mine those commodities. I do think that in an inflationary environment like we have, that does provide a bit of a tailwind for the commodities markets. On the flip side, we do have what has generally been a stronger dollar as of late, and most commodities around the world are valued in dollars. So that's a bit of an offsetting headwind. I will tell you, I have more commodity exposure in my growth portfolio than I have had in years. But whether or not it would be a more popular asset class generally than it was a few weeks ago, I don't really know how to answer that one.
Tell us why you have more in commodities, though. Is this a play on inflation?
This is to some extent a play on inflation, but most of the commodities that I'm investing in are energy related and or battery storage related commodities. So I view it more as a non-traditional way to play the transition from carbon-based energy to renewables. We're just not ready to make that jump yet. And I think that that opens up some opportunities where there's market inefficiency.
Right. You had mentioned that earlier. That's interesting. So two more quick questions for Bob, and then we'll bring this to a close. We've talked a lot about the U.S. today, but we had some news out from China overnight. The Chinese economy seems to be growing at a slower rate than had been expected, and certainly a slower rate than in the past. What's your quick take on China?
I personally consider, with the rarest of exceptions, China to be largely uninvestable at this point. It's interesting that the third quarter witnessed the largest outperformance of U.S. stocks over Chinese stocks in 20 years. Part of this is because China is slowing quite dramatically, but they're also experiencing huge energy shortages. They just sent out a mandate to acquire energy sources, quote unquote, at all cost. They also have a real estate bubble that could easily develop into a financial crisis. Real estate accounts for about 75% of household net worth in China. And it is really interesting to see what's going on in the Chinese debt markets, particularly their high yield bonds, where the yields are soaring to the highest levels that they've ever seen in China. Simultaneously, President Xi Jinping has been aggressively shifting China away from market-based capitalism, which has been the direction that they've been heading in, and really is adopting more of a populist redistributionism, where they're trying to spread wealth throughout the country and decentralize it from the entrepreneurs and the capitalists.
All right, thanks for that picture. And now, to bring you closer to home, you're calling us from Austin.
I am.
Tell me, I'm sorry?
I am, yes.
Yes, tell me just quickly, what's your take on the state of the Texas economy?
You know, Texas—
certainly energy-centered.
Well, energy is, you know, the strength of the energy sector is certainly helping Texas, though we're not seeing a lot of drilling in the fracking companies. They're not pursuing that right now. I think they're taking their profits and distributing them out more through dividends at this point. Texas does tend to be a very business-friendly state, and the fact it doesn't have a state income tax, I think, is very appealing to many businesses. That said, it's really a microcosm of the U.S. economy. Unfortunately, our vaccination rates for COVID trail the U.S., 55% versus 60, which may help to explain the slightly lower than national job growth that we've seen this year, which is 4.4% in Texas and 4.6% nationally. We also have a worse unemployment rate of 6.5% versus 5.9%, which is the national average. That said, labor conditions are very tight, and I can tell you as a business owner, it is really difficult to find and hire good qualified individuals right now. Texas is facing supply chain disruptions, a very high quit rate in terms of labor. We've got a shortage of qualified workers. All that being said, the manufacturing sector is robust and the service sector is improving. Inflation in wages and input prices are both increasingly problematic. In terms of real estate, which is a big industry in Texas, housing markets are extraordinarily hot. But office occupancy has dropped for six quarters in a row. And the worst of that is actually where I live in Austin, because so much of the population has an ability to work from home because it's such a technology-oriented economy. And we do have fairly high vacancy rates in our commercial buildings.
Sounds like much of the rest of the country.
I agree.
So thank you so much for joining us today. And thank you, Ben, as usual, for sharing your insights. It was a pleasure to have both of you on the call.
It's been my great pleasure.
Thank you, Lauren.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. Tomorrow on Barron's Live, Barron's Associate Editor for Technology, Eric Savitz, will speak with Micron Technology Chief Business Officer, Sumeet Sadana, about the outlook for the memory chip business, the ongoing component shortages, and what's coming next in PCs, 5G, and the cloud. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in today. Stay well and have a good day.